Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Run Brooks Show. And here we are. It's, what is it, Monday, July 9th, I think. It's hard to keep track. I've been swamped since the Objective Conferences, OCON, and trying to catch up on all the things that I did not get to do. Yeah, some of you had OCON blues yesterday. I just have OCON relief the last few days, trying to recover. And but I haven't done a show in a long time, so I figured I'd do one today. I just want to let everybody know that tomorrow we'll be doing a special show of the special episode of the Run Brooks Show. We'll be recapping the discussion with Jordan Peterson that we had at OCON. I'll be recapping that discussion with Greg Salimieri and Ankar Gatte. They're both going to join me here on the Run Brooks Show to talk Jordan Peterson and to talk about the event and what can be learned from it and what conclusions one can come from it. It should be a lot of fun. If you're interested in participating in that show and actually questions, then watch it live and be on YouTube and use Super Chat feature on YouTube to be able to ask questions of myself, of Ankar, and of Greg Salimieri. So it should be interesting. Greg and I participated. Ankar kind of watched it via live stream. So you'll get different perspectives on the same thing. We'll get Ankar's perspective kind of being on the sidelines and Greg and my perspective from actually being there. So, yeah. Looking forward to that. Should be fun. Today, I thought we would do something we haven't done in a while, which is one of our news shows. So kind of a review of the going over kind of the news of the day, of the week, of the month. I don't know, whatever comes up. And of course, I'm open to taking questions on the Super Chat. So those of you on YouTube can avail yourself of the Super Chat feature and ask questions. But, you know, to the extent that you can, make them newsy questions and avoid questions about Jordan Peterson in the debate, because we'll be doing that. And I keep calling it a debate, but it wasn't a debate. It was a conversation. Let's keep all of those focused on for tomorrow. As those of you on live stream, on YouTube, on Facebook know, I'm still in California. I'll be heading back to Puerto Rico on Saturday. So next week's shows, starting on Sunday, will be from Puerto Rico, and maybe I'll do a show from New York, because I will be in New York next week. Puerto Rico, then New York, then back to Puerto Rico, then back to California. Just a day in the life of your run book. All right. So I have a list of topics, a bunch of stuff to talk about. We're going to get to talk about immigration today a little bit. Not too deep, but I thought given all the discussion of immigration, it would be good to chime in a little bit about the illegal immigration and supposedly and everything else that's going on with immigration right now. Brexit is in the news, and tech monopolies seem always to be in the news. We'll talk about that. Should we start with something entertaining? We should start with something entertaining. This really came out of, I mentioned this during my talk about rational optimism at OCON, at the Objectivist Conference. Oh, yes. Any moment now, we shall hear who our next Supreme Court judge nominee at least is. It'll probably be affirmed, but who the nominee is going to be. I have got my suspicions. I think it's going to be a kind of a compromise nominee, the least controversial of them. All of them are bad, pretty bad on social issues. Two of them are probably good on property rights issues. None of them, I don't think, are good on privacy issues. Although one of them might be more of a Gorsuch type, who is not bad on those kind of issues. And what did I say? That none of them are good on social issues. Privacy, it's unclear. Property rights issues, I'm skeptical of two or three of them. So it'll be interesting. I'm not expecting much. I read a little bit about all four candidates, and I wasn't impressed by any of them. None of them seem as good even as Gorsuch, unfortunately. Telephone number doesn't work. I never gave you a telephone number, so I don't know what telephone number you're looking for. The way to ask a question, the only way to ask a question in these shows is by using Super Chat. $1, $2, you can get a question. And no, I'm not, there are no calls in. I'm not taking call-ins anymore, except on the Patreon shows, and then I take call-ins only from Patreon contributors. So you can do a Super Chat, and I will answer for $1 or $2. Be happy to answer any questions or address any comments you want to make, so you can write them in the comment space. So one kind of funny thing that happened to me on the way to WorkCon one morning, I mentioned this in my talk. I'm driving and I'm listening to NPR, and there was this very serious story about the latest doomsday scenario for the human race, and that is the idea that we're about to face Armageddon because of plastic. Plastic is the new climate change. Plastic is the new enemy. Plastic is about to destroy our lives. There's not enough landfill space, and it's clogging up the oceans, and it's just making life intolerable for human beings. Plastic is now the enemy. And that was a NPR story that I was listening to on the way in, and Seattle, in attempting to fight this once in a lifetime horrific, monstrous outcome of being killed by plastic, or the disappearance of civilization because of plastic. And I just read an article. There's another article out there about how recycling plastic is just not good enough, because plastic will destroy the earth even if it's recycled. I still don't get the complete logic of all of this, but this is what people believe. So plastic is the enemy. But since we can't, you know, the enemy is so vast and so big, we have to start chipping away at it. We have to start fighting it. We have to start the war on plastic. And the way we're going to start that war is we are going to ban plastic straws. Yes, you heard me right. Plastic straws, enemy number one. Enemy number one. So Seattle, always at the forefront of any progressive, life-enhancing activity, Seattle is banning plastic straws. And of course, we know that the most progressive company in Seattle, the one that sets all trends in the world, is Starbucks. And Starbucks announced today that it is going to ban plastic straws. So in the future, when you go to Starbucks, you will either get a paper straw, or you will get — paper straws don't act too well in liquids, but anyway, paper straw — or you will get some kind of organic straw, an organic straw that can then decompose and become part of Mother Earth and be a pro-life rather than plastic, which is the epitome of anti-life, evil demons that are going to destroy civilization and take over the world. Convinced? So yeah, so there is, I guess, a war on plastic, which is generated by people who don't care about human life. I can't think of — by the way, this all connects somehow to that scene, what was the movie called, with Dustin Hoffman, with the soundtrack by Simon and Garfunkel, Lady Robinson. What was the movie called? I can't say. Oh, The Graduate. You got to see the movie The Graduate. And in The Graduate, Dustin Hoffman, who's just graduated, I guess, he's lying in the pool on a float doing nothing, because that's what hippies in the 60s did. And that's what the meaning of life is, to do nothing. It's to be anti-conventional, to be anti-work, anti-everything. And his expected father-in-law, I think, comes in and says, "What are you going to do with your life?" And Dustin Hoffman says, "I don't know." And the father-in-law says, "I've just got one word for you, just one word: plastics." you got to go into plastics. That is the future. And it turns out that that was fantastic advice, because the plastic industry over the last 50, 60, 70 years has done phenomenally well. It has increased the standard of living and quality of life for all of us dramatically. Think of life without all the plastic containers that you use. Think of life without everything made from plastic, which is all around us, including my on my monitor here and my camera. Much of this camera up here is made of plastic, and just everything, man. You're surrounded by plastic. This speakerphone has plastic in it. Oh, these headphones, this is all plastic. Plastic, how could you live without plastic? Plastic is one of the wonders, seven wonders of the great world. Tupperware, of course, was the old day plastic. But think about all the stuff. The rim of this table is made of plastic. Think about all the stuff that is made of plastic in your world, in your life. Plastic is one of the great life enhancers. It's a product. It's a petroleum product, of course. Another reason why petroleum is such an important product. Another reason why fossil fuels, I love fossil fuels, I think is Alex Epstein's slogan, and he's absolutely right. I mean, chemical engineering, petroleum engineering produced these amazing plastics, and people who went into that in the 1960s have done very, very well, made a lot of money. So it turns out that the graduate, trying to be cynical and skeptical about plastics, which they attributed to boring, conventional, everybody goes into plastics, you know, they were wrong, because indeed plastic, the movie was wrong, because the plastics are indeed innovative, forward-looking, exciting, productive, life-enhancing, prosperity-enhancing, human flourishing. It's all about human flourishing. Plastics have had a lot to do with human flourishing over the last 50, 60, 70 years. So the guy in The Graduate, the Dustin Hoffman character, should have gone into plastics, and he'd be rich, happy, prosperous, successful today, until he encountered the idiots, the stupid idiots at NPR in Seattle. Well, NPR's not doing the band. In Seattle, in Starbucks, any in Portland probably. Anyway, that are trying to ban plastic stores. So we have a war on fossil fuels. We have a war against CO2. And now we have a war against plastic. Plastic enemy. All right. So, I thought that would be entertaining to start us off. All right, here's another one. You know, it's related to plastic, I guess. This one, let's see if I can. Oh, no, wrong article. Let's see, not that. This one. All right, so this is a Bloomberg article I found a few days ago. The title was kind of striking, and Robert Mayo says the Cameron to Rourke, watch the plastics. There's a whole new world coming from that. There is. Wow, I didn't know that was in. I don't know. Is that really from the Fountainhead, Robert? I don't know. All right, it's a good line. Here's the title of this article. I mean, this should make you curious. I wonder what they're talking about. But also very suspicious. Just the title should make you very suspicious. Here's the title. Too many of America's smartest waste their talents. Too many of America's smartest waste their talents. The first thing that pops into my head is, like, by what standard? Who gets to decide? Read the article, and it's like an egalitarian attack. It is the perfect egalitarian article for me. So it was just, this is how so many on the left think. Oh, somebody on the chat read the article. Isn't that amazing? Wow. Where was it? It was in Bloomberg. So it looks like who was it? DJ Fermi read the article. Yeah, it was by Noah Smith, a lefty, and it was in Bloomberg, Bloomberg.net, and it's too many Americans smartest waste their talent. And he starts off with this idea that let's see, where is that? Yeah, he starts out with the idea that there's this lawsuit now about the, you know, Harvard not discriminating against Asians, right? Harvard is discriminating against Asians. Asians score better on all the skill testing. They score worse in the personality tests. But Harvard has overweighted the personality tests in order to accept more white kids and fewer Asians. So there used to be a lot more Asians at Harvard, and now there are few Asians in Harvard, right? And so that's the starting off point from the article, and I was kind of curious where he was going to take this. But then what was interesting was that he took kind of a turn to the left, I guess, that I didn't expect. I expected him to take a turn, but not this particular turn. He said, you know, it's kind of interesting that we take these smart kids and we put them in the best institutions. And this is a great line. He says, education is costly to society. Costly to society. That's interesting terminology. I mean, who is society? Society is just a collection of individuals. So which individuals exactly is it costly to them? Is it mainly costly to the students because they have to take on debt? Is it costly to their parents because they have to subsidize it or pay for it? Society? I mean, what's society got to do with this? But the whole frame, notice, too many of America's smartest waste their talents. By what standard? Now I'm a little suspicious, right? It's probably by the standards of, quote, society. So he goes on and says, education is costly, and we take smart kids and we shower them with the best, most expensive educational resources. Again, those students all pay for it one way or the other. But okay, put that aside. And he's asking, where's the benefit, right? Where's the benefit? These kids get a good education, subsidized, I guess, by society. How does society get rewarded for all this investment in education? Now, this goes counter to other collectivists who always say, oh, we need to invest more in education because it's good for society. So he's saying, well, wait a minute. Is it true that getting an education at Harvard is good for society, particularly if you're really smart? Because if you're not that smart, he's okay with people coming to Harvard because then they get to maximize their ability. What he's really concerned about here is taking the smartest kids and putting them into Harvard, because then you're investing in the smartest kids. And then what do those smartest kids actually do, he tells us? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. They go and work in Wall Street. So half of Harvard seniors took jobs in finance or consulting. And he says that went down after the financial crisis. At least he's honest enough to change the stats once he realized he's wrong. But he says still more than a third. So he says more than a third of Harvard graduates, the smartest people in the world, because that's a criteria for accepting it into Harvard, are going to finance and consulting. And then he basically makes the statement. He says it this way. He says, but there's a growing sentiment. That's kind of interesting. Not growing thinking, not growing research, growing sentiment. There's a growing emotion that much of what finance industry does involves siphoning value from the rest of the economy. So the idea here is that top people are going into an industry that's fundamentally zero-sum game or maybe negative-sum game, and therefore hurting society after society, all in quotes, has invested heavily into their education. What a waste. We shouldn't let the smartest kids go to Harvard because we don't want them to land up in finance, although how you would prevent them. Imagine we had a system by which we didn't send the smartest kids to Harvard. We send the smartest kids to University of New Hampshire. I don't know why that came into my subconscious, but it did. Into the University of New Hampshire. And we send mediocre kids to Harvard. What do you think Wall Street would do? Do you think Wall Street would continue aimlessly, mindlessly, stupidly to keep hiring kids from Harvard? So even if you believe this nonsense about finance being a destructive endeavor, a negative-sum game for the economy, once they realized that Harvard was accepting mediocre kids or less than mediocre kids, would Wall Street firms filled with really, really smart people from previous generations at Harvard, continue to hire people from Harvard because they have Harvard under their name? Or would they now look for the people who are the smartest, who are now, I posit, at the University of New Hampshire? So, I mean, this is so stupid. I don't know where these people come from. I mean, obviously, this guy was not chosen to be at Harvard. Now, it'll turn out he was. But both ways it works, right? If it turns out that he actually went to Harvard, this Noah Smith went to Harvard, then it proves that Harvard is not accepting the smartest people in the world. Maybe they should accept more Asians. And if he didn't go to Harvard, then he's not one of the smartest people in the world. So, because that's a dumb argument even on its face. And I'm not even talking about the fact that, as I wrote in my recent book about finance, The Wealth Creators, finance is far, far from a zero-sum, unproductive industry. It is the industry most crucial for production. It is the industry that sets the standard for all production. So, you know, he says, many of the country's best and brightest are either exerting their talent, trying to beat each other out in the zero-sum trading game. In the book, I explain why trading is not zero-sum, or exploiting legal and behavioral loopholes to part investors from their money. You know, those stupid investors, because the investors didn't go to Harvard. Now, why didn't the investors go to Harvard? Because they're in finance, too. And you know the investors. So it's the people running big pension funds, big insurance companies. How about investors who are running hedge funds? So those are, but these investors, I guess the hedge funds are being run by the Harvard guys. So they're really, really smart, and they're using their smarts to get pension plans and insurance companies and you know, high net worth individuals and other, you know, pretty dumb people, I guess, to give them money to invest for them at exorbitant fees. That's what he's arguing. Excessive money management fees. I mean, where do these guys get off? Where do these guys get off at being this detached from reality and this dumb? To run a fund, you have to be very smart. Nobody's going to give you money if you underperform. Figuring out who's an underperformer and who's an overperformer is the difficult task, because you have to take into account risk, not only return. So how do we know that management fees are excessive? Who gets to decide that? Don't you think the market is smarter than this Noah Smith guy in determining, given that they're paying these fees? Maybe they're not excessive fees. Now, granted, I am part of a management team that runs a hedge fund, so full disclosure, I have an incentive to argue that fees are not excessive because I get paid some of those fees. But really, this Noah Smith guy, or whoever these researchers are supposedly, are smarter than the marketplace. The little central planners know how much fees should be. So, and then he says, of course, this is the traditional, another one of the arguments, that we're having more and more concentration in industry. I would argue, so companies becoming bigger and bigger and having more and more power, market power. I would argue that the only reason that's existing is because of regulations and because of politics. We can, you know, that's a separate discussion. So it gives these superstars who come out of Harvard and then they go into these companies, more and more power. But now he gets the crux of it, right? What does he want these smart kids to actually be doing? Again, the article is completely illogical in its flow, because again, how is this connected to Harvard not accepting Asians in? How's this related to the argument that Harvard is discriminating? He never says. He's just using it as a hook that means nothing. What he is saying, this is what he says. He says that ultimately what he says is the jobs that are really meaningful in a society, the jobs that really make a difference long term in a society, are government jobs, are the bureaucracy. He says, you know, in Japan, traditionally, not anymore, not in recent years, but traditionally, The smartest kids went to the bureaucracy. Now, this is after he says how much the U.S. economy is not doing that well and all of this, and we have an inefficient economic system. Has he looked at Japan? Has he looked at their system, their centrally controlled, their centrally managed system, and how stagnant it has been for almost forever, basically, for 30 years now? Maybe because the smartest and brightest went to the bureaucracy, tried to centrally plan the economy, and caused the disaster that was the 1980s, 90s, and ever since then, just stagnation. We have done our economy as bad as it has done. I don't think it's done well. Certainly not done well relative to what it could do. Has done a thousand times better than the, well, a thousand times is exaggerating, a lot better than the Japanese economy, in spite of the fact that we are losing the best and the brightest. Instead of going into government jobs, they are going to finance. Oh my God, it's almost as bad as plastic straws. Almost. Not quite as bad, but almost. So he wants the best and the brightest to go to government. Now, this is a long tradition in Europe and in Asia and in Japan in particular. For the best and the brightest, indeed, do go into the bureaucracy. A job in the bureaucracy is a lifetime job. You'll never be fired. It's supposed to be a more intellectual job. Sure. I mean, central planning is hard. It's futile. It's stupid. It's bad for society because it's bad for the individuals in society. But it's very complex and hard and challenging, and you get lots of vacation and you get tenure. So smart people go for that in Europe, in Japan. And that's the model. The model is to turn America into Europe. That's what the left has wanted for a long, long, long time. The other profession that he thinks is a good profession is teaching. And he says it's Finland, which has one of the world's best education system. Maybe it has one of the world's best education system. It's still pretty crummy, but maybe it's one of the best. Teaching is a highly prized profession. Right? Whereas he says in the United States, we are starved for talent in teaching, and we don't compensate the teachers enough, right? And he talks about American teachers continue to stagnate. So he links, under stagnate, he links to an article. So I was expecting an article that says teacher wages haven't gone up in a long, long time, and as a consequence, teaching is stagnated. Instead, what the article actually says, this is from the leftist Brookings Institute, but Brookings is not that bad. It says what's actually stagnated is teachers' ability to innovate in the classroom. And what actually stagnated is their pay. But it says the big issue is that school districts cannot pay good teachers more than bad teachers. School districts cannot allow, because of conformity to one standard, because of teachers' unions, they cannot allow for experimentation and innovation and flexibility with the curricula. And basically, the rewarding of good teachers and good methods and good pedagogy, because that's against union policy and that's against the framework of educational policy. So, yeah, I agree with Noah. It would be great if we had more good teachers. It would be great if more of our smartest and best and brightest, the entrepreneurial minds, went into education. But that's not going to happen as long as you have a teachers' union controlling education. That's not going to happen as long as you have government schools, as long as you have public education. So, yeah, if you want the best and the brightest, the entrepreneurs, the innovators, to go into education, then you must privatize it all. Privatize education, sell the schools. And if you did that, and I've talked a lot about how you would do that and why the poor wouldn't suffer under such a system and why there's a transition mechanism that would guarantee that the poor had money to pay for these private schools. But if you did that, then the best and the brightest would go into education and you solve the problem. So what's striking about Noah's article in Bloomberg, Noah Smith, is how collectivist it is, how central planning oriented it is. The best and the brightest should be central planners, and hey, they would know the best return on education for society and therefore be able to funnel the money in the right direction towards the right goals. I mean, what they want us to become is stagnant Japan and stagnant Europe. And lots of people want that. That is, it's sad the extent to which people want us to become Europe. All right. So that's the return on education, the value of education. So I'm for Harvard deciding whoever the hell they want to bring in. I'm for doing away with all quotas and letting schools, if schools want to only bring in students who are smart, that's fine. If schools want to only bring in students who are stupid, that's fine with me too. If schools only want to bring in white kids, I think they should be allowed to do so. They should publish those criteria. I think that would make sense. But, you know, get rid of affirmative action, get rid of all these quotas, let universities, particularly private universities like Harvard, do whatever the hell they want. They should be allowed to discriminate against Asians if they want to, even though Asians score better than all other students applying to Harvard. It's their university. They get to decide. And then, you know, I'm not going to argue finance is a productive activity. You know my views, and you can read my book, The Wealth Creators. It's on Amazon. You can buy it. Anyway, Noah, you're wrong from beginning to end. You're wrong. All right, we have some Super Chat questions. We've got one on Japan. Oh, we've got one. Okay, I don't see a question there. That looks like just a comment. Okay, the first question is thoughts on Christopher Hitchens. All right, I'm not really prepared for this, but let me give you kind of off the top of my mind thoughts on Christopher Hitchens. Really smart guy, really eloquent, always enjoyed listening to him. Obviously on economic issues, quite a lefty, used to be a real socialist, used to wear red socks. He actually engaged in a debate with Harry Binswanger. I always thought it was Peacock, but it turns out it was Harry Binswanger. I cannot find video or audio of it. I'll check in the Ayn Rand Institute archives to see if we can find anything. But there was a debate with Christopher Hitchens on one side and Harry Binswanger on the other side. I think it was 2-2. I'm not sure. I think it was Harry Binswanger and John Redpath. And Christopher Hitchens was defending socialism, and that was in the early to mid 80s. Hitchens changed, and he kept moving to the right, both on economic issues, but most meaningfully on foreign policy, and moved significantly to the right on foreign policy. It was quite good, I thought, after 9/11, particularly with his fellows on the left, him criticizing them for refusing to accept the responsibility of Islam as a religion for what happened on 9/11, for the terrorism of 9/11 and terrorist attacks that followed that. He, like Sam Harris, had I think a proper view of Islam as a horrible ideology that some interpretations of lead to this amazing violence, and that you couldn't separate the violence from the religion itself. So he was very good in that. And of course, the thing he maybe is most known for is his being part of the New Atheists, the group with Sam Harris and Dawkins and others, who coming really out of 9/11, I think, and their attack on Islam really began attacking religion more broadly and presenting new arguments, really old arguments in a new packaging to a young audience about the evils of religion or the negative aspects of religion and why atheism was the right position. I think he did a lot of good work there, and he was quite good quite good in these issues. So on Islam and on religion, he was very good. I'll give him one more credit, and that is that Christopher Hitchens disliked Ayn Rand very much philosophically. He was a huge opponent of Ayn Rand. But this is the difference. He knew she was the enemy, and he mentions her a lot in his speeches. So, wow, I mean, that's great when a leading intellectual of our time actually recognized Ayn Rand as having significance and importance enough to talk a lot about. That is a good thing. He, like many others, misrepresented her views, But I think that's makes sense because I don't think they have a framework from which to understand what she actually said. They can't separate, for example, her conception of self-interest and the conventional conception of self-interest. They can't compute. It doesn't fit. They're so embedded in the Christian view of altruism, in the Christian view of all of this that you know they can't get out of it. So you know, so I like Christopher Hitchens. I like the fact that he respected Ayn Rand. Oh, by the way, he wrote this brilliant book on Mother Teresa, and was very good on Mother Teresa on how horrible of a woman she was. I mean, he doesn't give quite a philosophical explanation why she was horrible, because he still views it through the frame of altruism, as we would. That is, she's a horrible person primarily because she just wasted her own life and advocated for philosophy, Christian altruism, that is evil. But he was great in terms of analyzing her diaries and showing what a miserable, pathetic, angry human being Mother Teresa was. I mean, ugh, she was really horrible. So, yeah, I mean, mixed. I wish, like most of the atheists, the new atheists, I wish they were original thinkers, and I wish they could comprehend Ayn Rand's views and Ayn Rand's philosophy, particularly in ethics, where I think they're so damn conventional when it comes to ethics, that it's frustrating. It's incredibly frustrating. You know, you can see that with Sam Harris. You certainly see it with Hitchens. Dawkins is in some ways even worse than that. But they were interesting intellectuals who I thought did some good and created some interesting discussion in the world around us. All right. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, or if you'd like to know, like somebody on YouTube wants to know my views on The Seventh Samurai by Akira Kurosawa and other good Kurosawa movies, you can ask me by using Super Chat. Press the Super Chat button in YouTube, and you know, for a buck or two, I will tell you what I think of those movies. Let's see. There's a $10 Super Chat here, but he says no question. But thanks, Ian. Thanks for the contribution. And yes, I loved Okan, and I see you did too, so that's great. And tomorrow you'll find out what I thought and what other thoughts about the conversation with Jordan Peterson. Okay, avid film buff. You know, I love to talk movies sometime. But he asked, what do you think of Japanese schools? They struck me as highly collectivist. Yes, I mean, I think the problem with Japanese schools is the extent to which they train the students to be collectivist. Now, I'm not an expert in this field. I read some years ago about Japanese schools and about Japanese education, and it was very, very, very collectivist, rigid, regimented, did not encourage independent thinking at all, did not encourage innovation, did not encourage creativity, and they really ran up against this. So Japan was very good at copying and then at making things much better. It wasn't strong in innovation. It wasn't strong on, it's not strong with new science. It's not strong on taking science and turning it into new technology. And I think partially that is a consequence, or a large extent that is a consequence of just an educational system, which de-emphasizes that kind of innovative, first-handed thinking that is required to be a good scientist, an innovative scientist, that is required to be an entrepreneur and an innovator. Now, they're very good entrepreneurs. Look at people like Honda and a lot of their, big industries were created by entrepreneurs. However, mostly they took existing technology that was developed in Europe or in the United States, and they improved it. They're very good at improving. They're not good at innovating and creating new stuff. You know, again, the educational system just is very conformist. It trains conformist. And if you go to Japan, you'll see, I mean, again, this is caricaturing, I know, and my Japanese friends, I apologize. I know there are exceptions, and I know that this is not everything and everywhere. And I love going to Tokyo, and I love speaking to Japanese objectivists. I have to make all these caveats not to insult anybody. But my sense generally is that Japanese culture is very collectivistic, very conformist. That is a consequence of being a conformist culture. During their teenage years, Japanese tend to rebel. And then when they get a job, they tend to conform again. As a consequence, and the educational system pushes that, and so do most of the workplaces push for that. And again, I'm not convinced that that is always the case. I know that that's not always the case, and not every company is like that, but that is the general trend. And as a consequence, again, they're very risk-averse, non-questioning, and non-innovative. Okay, so I will go back to my topics, unless there's more super chat going on YouTube. All right, so I want to talk about a topic that's going to piss off a bunch of people, but that's okay. All right, we got a quick super chat before we get to immigration. I found your work delving into some Jordan Peterson podcast. What are your thoughts on his work? You should go on Ruben Crowder, Rogan, etc. Okay, so let's just do this quickly. I'm not going to talk about Jordan Peterson. We're going to do that tomorrow. Also, I've got at least one very long podcast, YouTube video, where I just talk about Jordan Peterson. So look, you're on book Jordan Peterson, and you'll find a bunch of stuff. I just did like a conversation / debate with Jordan Peterson with Greg Salamieri as well, primarily Greg Salamieri, at OCON, so you can watch that. All these videos are available either on my channel, or the discussion with Jordan Peterson is available on Dave Rubin's channel. In addition, if you go to Dave Rubin's channel, you'll find two interviews I did with Dave Rubin, lengthy interviews I did with Dave Rubin, plus another two public events I did with Dave Rubin. So there are four videos on Dave Rubin's channel with me and Dave talking. So there's tons of that content. I have been on Crowder, but he put it behind the firewall. I'd love to be on Crowder again, but I have not been on. On Joe Rogan, you know, we are trying to get Joe Rogan to invite me. I can't go on the show without his inviting me. So it would be nice if Joe invited me on his show. I'm waiting for the invitation. Dave was on his show a few weeks ago, told Joe, you got to invite you on Brooke. Hasn't happened yet. So, and Dave did introduce us by email. I emailed Joe, did not hear from him. So I'm waiting for the Joe Rogan invitation any day now. I'm also open to being on Crowder's podcast again. This time not behind the firewall. I hope that would be nice. Justin, you've got a lot to listen to. There's a tons and tons of content out there by me addressing Jordan Peterson in this context, but a lot of other things. So enjoy the content, free content. And if you like it, you should go to Patreon and become a supporter on Patreon. You get a bunch of different perks, and you also get this. So, oh, wow. I said I'm going to talk about immigration, and like the number of people on Facebook listening to this just plummeted. I lost about a third of the people listening on Patreon, on Facebook, because I said I would talk about immigration. So you've got my I should have said this. Thanks, Justin, for reminding me. But I put up on YouTube my financial crisis lectures. Now, I don't have video for them, so it's audio only. But I figure a lot of people put up audio only on YouTube, and a lot of you don't mind that because you're listening, you're not watching anyway. And I know a lot of you didn't listen to it just because of the numbers. There are quite a few who didn't listen to it when I put it up as a podcast on iTunes and other places. So it's on YouTube, all three parts of it. Coming soon, very soon, will be my history of the Middle East, my history of Islamic totalitarianism, my history and assessment of the corporation and corporations, and a lot of my, so all of my courses, in addition to being available as podcasts, are now going to go up on YouTube. So enjoy, share, let your friends know. I don't think you'll find anything better on the financial crisis out there, other than maybe John Allison's book, but on YouTube or on a podcast. I don't think you'll find anything better in terms of YouTube or podcast on the history of the Middle East, or anything better on the history of Islamic totalitarianism or what some call Islamism or jihadism. I don't think you'll find anything better than my courses for those. Those are all going up in the weeks to come. So stay tuned to my channel. Of course, don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel. That way you'll get a notification once this material goes up. You know what would be fascinating is to do a history of immigration in the United States. You know, I'll have to do that sometime. Anyway, I wanted to comment, and I'm not going to comment on this whole child separation thing, because I think it's such an abomination and so un-American and so frigging ridiculous that, you know, I just get too angry to comment on it. You know, it just drives me crazy about these things that an America would treat a misdemeanor, which is what somebody crossing the border into the United States without a visa is, would treat it as a criminal offense, the extent that it's being treated, and the parents would be separated. Can you imagine being separated from your child, particularly your baby? And put aside, yes, I'm sure some immigrants are finding orphans and bringing them across just to get sympathy. And of course, the purpose of all of this get tough with illegal immigrants is to stop the flow, to try to convince the Guatemalans and the Hondurans and the Nicaraguans that if they get caught, they're going to be so treated so badly that they shouldn't come. I break the law every day. I speed. Should we put me under arrest every time I speed? I probably break the law in other ways as well. I mean, there's always been a distinction between some laws and other laws. Some laws, yeah, you go to jail, they throw away the key. We even have the death penalty. We don't punish, justice demands that we don't treat every person who breaks the law the same. There is proportionality in terms of the kind of punishment you exert on a person depends on the kind of law that they have broken. And to elevate the idea of illegally coming into this country without a visa, without documentation, to elevate that to the point of criminal prosecution the way they're doing, and therefore having to separate the kids because the kids can't be in detention for criminal prosecution with their parents, is ridiculous. William, of course, spouts the fake news that 80% of these kids are not with their parents. That is just not true. And that's the other thing, that the immigration debate, because it is so focused on emotion and not a fact, because the president of the United States constantly lies about immigration, we'll get to that in a minute, he has given you all a carte blanche and a thumbs up to lie about immigration, because so many people get their immigration statistics from people who don't know what they're talking about and who've never seen a statistic in their life. The debate is filled with lies on both sides, lies rather than actual facts. And that's what I wanted to talk about today is some of the lying that is involved in this. Now, I ought also say that while last year, because of Trump, it looks like illegal immigration declined a little bit. There were a few apprehensions at the border last year because people were afraid of Trump. This year, illegal immigration has gone through the roof. And not gone through the roof. It's accelerated. Now, it's still way, 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 way lower. I mean, this is the whole thing about illegal immigration. Illegal immigration is far, far lower today than it was in the 90s and the early 2000s. It's less than a quarter of the number. But the reason for the increase in illegal immigration right now is, one, the economy is doing well. Two, and there's a massive shortage of people in the United States in terms of jobs. If you look at jobs data, you can see that there are many, many more jobs available, particularly at the low end, but at all levels. And of course, immigration creates huge numbers of jobs. There are not enough immigrants to fill those jobs. That is, there are not enough legal immigrants coming into this country to fill all the jobs. And as a consequence, there's a lot of job vacancies to be filled by illegal immigrants, and that creates a pull. Now, there's also a push. There is a lot of really, really horrible stuff happening in Honduras, and particularly right now in Nicaragua and in Guatemala, that is driving, because of gangs, because of violence, because of political instability, that is driving people, that they become less risk-averse, and they're willing to take on more risk to try to get to the United States, to try to get to freedom and liberty. I've said before, I admire people who try to make their life better. I admire people who try to cross the United States border. Whatever you think the United States should do about them, you have to recognize that the people coming here are trying to make their own lives and their children's lives better. And that is a virtue. That is not a vice by any objective standard. It is a virtue to make your life, to try to make your life, to work to make your life better. So if you're in Guatemala, you almost have an egoist to the extent that they are. If they care about their own life, then I admire taking your kids and trying to cross the U.S. border, because your kids are less in danger by trying to cross the U.S. border, it turns out, than by staying in some of these countries because they're so violent and your kids getting involved in gangs. So it is unbelievable to me that we, you know, this, the land that admires liberty, that a land that admires people striving towards being free, striving towards liberty, does not admire those people trying to come into this country. You could say somewhat legitimately, that we should stop them from coming in and send them back. Okay, we still have to admire their attempt to come here, no matter what, because they're trying to make their lives and their children's lives better. And thumbs up to that. I'm a huge admirer of that. And that is what most of these people are trying to do. Sure, the criminal elements that are coming in with them, but most of them, the overwhelming majority of them, are coming over to make their lives better. And I hugely admire that. So here's something Donald Trump said. Here's Donald Trump said, and again, I don't want to get into the discussion about whether, you know, whether they are socialist or whether they would vote Democratic, all of that. I'm putting that aside. So you might have a seemingly reason to keep them out. That doesn't, a country is not a house. Right? You know, by that definition, I mean, all immigrants are breaking into the house. That is ridiculous. So the conflation of private property with a country, with a political entity, if they break into your house, put them in jail, throw away the keys. I don't care. If they commit a crime in the United States, put them in jail, throw away the keys. I don't care. But what? This is a house? You don't have private property over the entire country? What if I invite one of these people to my house? Do you have the right to break into my house, drag them out, and deport them? You do, according to immigration laws today and the behavior of ICE and behavior of the immigration authority. So don't pretend that you care about private property, because you don't. You don't care about my private property. If I bring somebody into my house, what is it any of your business? So I'm all for legal immigration. I just think we have too little of it. And as a consequence, we create the incentive to have illegal immigration. Let's go for legal immigration. But by the way, that's not what Trump is advocating for. He wants to shrink legal immigration as well as illegal immigration. He wants to shrink legal immigration by at least half. So I'm pro-immigration. I want huge amounts of legal immigrants to come into this country. And that's how you shrink illegal immigration, by making it relatively easy. I'm also, as I've said many times, for legal immigration if you get a job, right? If you get a job. What sources are you using? I'm not sure what you mean by what sources I'm using. For what? So let's look at the statement by Donald Trump that he made June 22nd as part of his explanation for why he believes that, why he thinks that illegal immigration should stop. This is his motivation, why the separation of families is justified. And in terms of the nonviolence, I'm going to get to that. I'm going to get to the stats and where I get them in a minute. So here are a few statistics on the human toll of illegal immigration. Now note that first sentence. This is Donald Trump speaking, not me. Here are just a few statistics on the human toll of illegal immigration. Remember that. According to a 2011 government report, the arrests attached to the criminal alien population included an estimated 25,000 people for homicide, 42,000 for robbery, nearly 70,000 for sex offense, and nearly 15,000 for kidnapping. Okay? So we start off with that. Right, we'll start off with that sentence. These are, he says, statistics about the human toll of illegal immigration. So first, a fact. I don't care if it's left, I don't care if it comes to the right, a fact about statistics relating crime to immigration. We don't have them. They do not exist. Anytime you hear somebody, particular Ann Coulter and her ilk, giving you statistics about crime and illegal immigration, they don't know what they are talking about because the stats don't exist or they are very, very limited and people extrapolate from them. Both sides, honest people on both sides acknowledge that it's impossible to quantify the impact on crime rates from illegal immigration because there is no, emphasis, no, nationwide data tracking of offenders by the immigration status. So when the police arrest somebody, they don't check legal, illegal, born in the U.S., citizen, not citizen. That doesn't exist. Even the Cato stuff is extrapolation from some data that they have. And I like the Cato work on immigration and the stats. But at the end of the day, real data, nationwide data, does not exist. So when the president says that the criminal area population included an estimated 25,000 people for homicide, 42 for robberies, he's bullshitting you. He is lying, because those numbers don't exist. Those numbers do not exist. Now, so what is the numbers he's giving? Because he's not making them up. He's just lying about them. Well, first point to make, all the numbers President Trump uses there are numbers that combine legal and illegal immigration. Yeah, even though he says in his first sentence, this is just a few statistics on the human toll of illegal immigration, he is combining both legal and illegal immigration in the stats that he is using, which is, again, just a bold-faced manipulative lie. So he's combining arrest statistics for legal and undocumented immigrants. Okay. Now, even if the numbers are true, this is a 2011 government report. Again, this is these are estimates. These are, let me see, these are lumping illegal and legal immigrants together. But even if this were true, even if the 20, actually, the report said there were 25,064 homicide arrests from both classes of immigrants. Even if that number is accurate. During that period, this is a period, by the way, from August 1955 to April 2010. August 1955 to April 2010. So this is a long period, which the president did not say. He didn't say how long of a period. It sounds really scary. Illegal immigrants are responsible for 25,000 murders. Over what period of time? Over what period of time? He doesn't say, because he, the whole goal of his rhetoric is to scare you, not to provide you with facts, but to scare you, lying through his teeth. So even if it was true, even if every one of them was convicted, because that's not what the data says. The data just said they were arrested. How many of them were convicted? How much of that is of the total arrests? Of the total homicides committed during that period of time. So it turns out there were 934,000 homicides during that period. So even if every one of them was convicted, and we're assuming that for every homicide there's just one person responsible, again, an assumption, and then nobody was arrested twice, they were only arrested once, then approximately 2.7% of all homicides during that 55-year period were committed by non-citizens, 2.7%. But legal and illegal immigrants, by any calculation, were, during that period, at least 4.6% of the population, which means that they committed fewer murders as a percentage than the rest of the population. I mean, again, we're making lots of assumptions here, lots of assumptions. But even if you accept all the assumptions, even if you accept the president at his word, then what the number actually proves is that illegal immigrants committed fewer crimes than illegal plus legal immigrants committed fewer crimes than Americans who are not immigrants. So none of that is true. None of the numbers are true. None of the numbers are accurate. There's almost no way to draw any implications from this. But that's what it is. You know, all politicians lie, but Trump lies a lot more. And Trump doesn't care that he lies. Most other politicians lie in a way where they're trying to hide the lie. Donald Trump just lies and actually relishes the lie. So that's that sentence. Let's take the next sentence in his thing. He relishes lying and he lies with statistics. I mean, they all lie with statistics, right? Every one of them. But this is so bold-faced. And again, you know, I would happily do this to President Obama as well. And did do it with President Obama as well. Okay, in Texas alone, he says, he continues that quote. Within the last 7 years, more than 250,000 criminal aliens have been arrested and charged with over 600,000 criminal offenses. Wow, that sounds very, very, very bad. So again, 250,000 criminal aliens. Now, that 250,000 number, again, comes from a Texas study. That, again, is legal and illegals combined. But he said he was only talking about illegal immigrants. But this number is combined legal and illegal immigrants. So, again, he's using the wrong number. And the reason he's using the wrong number is because he doesn't have data on the right number. All right, let me see. So now what is interesting, and actually, and this is from Cato, is that we actually do have in Texas, is one of the only states where we actually do have numbers of crimes committed by illegal immigrants. So why didn't the president use the illegal immigrant number? Because it's not that dramatic. It's not that dramatic. Right. So he's over-dramatizing that. Over-dramatizing it to make it seem like, oh my God, illegal immigrants are destroying this country. But none of this is true. You know, guys, if you don't believe me, you can do your own research. Nothing special about the research I do. You can find all this stuff online, right? You just have to be selective in how you do the research and check different sources. And, you know, Cato is one. There are a lot of other immigration websites, pro and anti-immigration. And you can corroborate. You can match up the data and see what it shows you. Again, and the fact that Trump is combining legal and illegal immigrants, that's just easy to find. That is easy to find. Okay. Criminal aliens arrested between 2011 and 2017, legal and illegal, were charged with 638,411 criminal offenses over the course of their criminal career. So this is more than one offense per person, and they could be charged, the one person could be charged with 10 offenses. But it's still, you count all the offenses, so the number seems massive, but in terms of actual criminals, much smaller. Okay, here's one more sentence from Trump, and then I'll look at some of your Super Chat questions and answer them. 63,000 Americans have been killed by illegal aliens since 9/11. And that number, they say, is very low because things aren't reported. 63,000. And you don't hear about that. So somebody did forensic about the statistics and went in and found that this comes from a 2006 blog by Representative Stephen King, a well-known anti-immigration Republican. And it's just a bizarre claim. So first, they use the statistics of how many criminal aliens are in federal jails. And in federal jails, about 28% of all the inmates in federal jails are legal or illegal aliens. So again, conflating legal and illegal. But we gotten over that, right? We know he lies about that. So legal and illegal immigrants, 28% of them are in federal jail. But federal jail only constitute 10% of all criminals in the country. because the other 90% are in state jails, and we have no statistics about state jails. So we take the 28% in federal jails, and then we say because 28% of the immigrants in 28% of the people in federal jail are immigrants, therefore 28% of the murders are committed by immigrants, 28% of rapes are committed by immigrants, 28% of violence and assault and battery are committed by immigrants. That's just bizarre. That is just bizarre. It turns out that many of those sitting in federal jail who are immigrants are there because they violated immigration law. And they're not criminal, they're not violent immigrants at all. So it's complete nonsense. Complete nonsense. So then they take the 28% and they multiply by the number of murders that happened since 9/11, and they get this number of 63,000. I mean, talk about disgusting. Talk about lying. Talk about just making stuff, using statistics to make stuff up. It's just despicable. Despicable. It really is. I mean, this is not sophisticated. This is not sophisticated statistics. This is pretty simple statistics. Again, Jesus Christ is posting here on it's great to have Jesus listening to your podcast, but he is citing numbers about how many people are incarcerated. Again, you don't know that because they all don't know numbers from state penitentiaries. All you can say is the number of people incarcerated in federal prisons. We have no numbers from federal prison. We've got some questions. Okay, well, what should happen to immigrants across the border with or without children illegally? I mean, most of them should be sent back, I guess, with or without, they should go through, they should have an opportunity to apply by the U.S. laws. I think you can apply for asylum and things like that through U.S. law, and you should be sent back fairly quickly. They should try to process these things fairly quickly. Again, if you're seeking asylum and there's some legitimacy to your case, then it would take longer. You would have to be, put up. Oh, so it's Kavanaugh. Kavanaugh was appointed. All right. I'll comment on Kavanaugh in a minute. So Kavanaugh is one of the more conservative judges that were the possibilities. He is a political appointee because he's very Republican. Not only is he very conservative, but very Republican. He was part of the Kent Starr investigation of Clinton. We'll get to Kavanaugh in a second. I think that's what would happen today. But my view is stop thinking about what would happen today. The real issue is, how do we reform our immigration system? How do we change our legal immigration system? Let me just change the lighting here a little bit. That's better. How do we change our legal immigration system to increase the number of legal immigration so more of these people can stay? How do we change our welfare system so that they don't get welfare? They already, most of them don't get welfare because they're illegal and because you can't get welfare for the first 5 years. But it's a misdemeanor, so you treat it as a misdemeanor. You treat it, the law is pretty straightforward. You just stop this so-called zero tolerance, separating families, making a big deal out of this, and instead just apply the law as it's always been applied, but focus on changing the law. Focus on increasing the number, significantly increasing the number of legal immigrants, not just at the bottom, but at the top end. Create different categories for legal immigrants to come here to work. Focus immigration on work rather than on anything else. That would be the way to do it today. Again, I've talked a lot about immigration, what rational immigration looks like today, what it looks like in a perfect society. You can look those up in my previous podcast. I don't want to have to repeat all that. I would agree most of the crime that is committed by illegals is because of the drug war, which is a stain on U.S. crime policy to begin with. Absolutely. So start with that. The drug war is to the extent that illegals are committing crime, it's mostly associated with the drug war. This gang, which is truly horrible, that Trump talks a lot about, that is comprised in the United States of a lot of illegal immigrants. It's truly evil. that gang exists because of the drug war. So get rid of the drug war. Stop. Decriminalize all drugs. Not just marijuana, but all drugs. If you decriminalize all drugs, MS-13 would go bankrupt. And that's the best, you know, other than putting them all in jail, which seems to be very difficult, particularly given that most of them outside the United States, that is probably the best way to deal with it. And that would solve the problem of illegals trying to come in for the purposes of crime, because most of the crime related to drug war. So get rid of the drug war. Eliminate the drug war by turning them into positives. What are good sites for all types of statistics? There are no good sites for all types of statistics. I mean, I wish there were, but different sites are good for different types of statistics. I would definitely read Cato on immigration, but I think Cato's biased on the other side. Cato wants you to think that there's never a problem with immigration. Everything's hunky-dory. And you know, mostly I agree with them, but I think they overplay what their statistics are actually showing them. So I have to be fair and say that even though I agree with Cato on their conclusions, I don't think those conclusions are always warranted based on the statistics that they use. And they are fairly careful in, to give them credit, on their interpretation of statistics. So they're not, they always tell you, you know, these statistics are weak. It's hard to get the data. The data is not comprehensive, all of that stuff. Whereas people on the anti-immigration side sometimes say that, sometimes they actually give you the proper statistics and the proper data, and they give you the right caveats, but often they don't do any of that. So you have to be very, very careful of statistics. You have to know what the statistic is measuring. Like in Donald Trump's case here, he's giving statistics for the wrong thing. He's not giving statistics about illegals at all. And then particularly the one about 63,000 murders, that is just so science fiction. That is just a made-up number. That is a purely made-up number. So look, I'm not arguing what the actual numbers are, because I don't know what the actual numbers are, because nobody knows what the actual numbers are. I think Cato probably comes closest to those numbers. But what I'm saying here is that Trump is making them up, and they're complete and utter creations, and they cannot be relied on. And if you want to make a case against immigration, cannot be made on these numbers. It cannot be made on any crime numbers. And indeed, I don't think it's an empirical question. I think the issue of immigration is a moral question and a political question. Make it on the basis of rights. Make it on the basis, and that's my position, pro-immigration is on the basis of rights. So make the numbers, make the argument on rights. And if you have a political rights-based argument to limit immigration to the extent that that Trump wants to, then make that argument. But unfortunately, that's not the argument most people make, and it's not the argument Trump makes. And you know, some objectivists try to make a rights argument. I think it's flawed. But my position again is to maximize immigration and to maximize legal immigration, and to do that would mean basically to give visas to anybody who can find a job in the U.S. That would be my short-term solution to the immigration crisis. And again, I've talked about that a lot. Okay, let's talk about, let me just verify, because who knows, who was it who told me? Let's see if I can count on the source. It's Bob Stubblefield. So it is Kavanaugh. I don't have to look it up. So Kavanaugh is the new Supreme Court judge. You know, my first thing that comes to mind is that Roe versus Wade is in deep, deep trouble. So the right to an abortion is in deep trouble. The only thing stopping, I think, the court overthrowing, throwing out the Roe versus Wade is Roberts. I think Roberts would probably vote against overriding Roe versus Wade, because I think he respects precedent. So even though Roe versus Wade was not very well argued, the conclusion was the right conclusion, and the conclusion was one that I support. I am pro-abortion. I'm pro a woman's right to an abortion. I think it is a right, because she has a right over her body, and she has a right to do with her body as she sees fit. But so this nomination is bad for abortion, although I'm hoping that Roberts helps preserve that right, the recognition of that right. I don't know much about Kavanaugh in terms of property rights, privacy. There's a lot of conflicting information about it, so it's really, really hard to tell. So how he's going to rule. I'm looking forward to seeing as the process now goes through kind of what is his positions. The nice thing about Gorsuch is that even though I disagree with him on some things, he's quite good on other things, maybe better than Scalia even on some things. And Scalia wasn't that good. Scalia was bad. And on things Scalia was bad, for example, giving the executive branch huge amounts of power, it looks like Gorsuch is against that. I think, though, that Kavanaugh, one of the reasons Kavanaugh might have been elected is because Kavanaugh is a huge proponent of executive power. And, you know, Trump, maybe because of the Russia probe, is worried about what happens if that comes to the Supreme Court. Kavanaugh would rule with him because he gives the president a lot of leeway when it comes to criminal prosecution and civil prosecution. So, again, Kavanaugh's a Republican. He was part of Ken Starr's investigation of Bill Clinton, which I don't think was that impressive. I'm very, very apprehensive about Kavanaugh being nominated to Supreme Court, much more apprehensive than it was about Gorsuch. It worries me. It worries me because I think he's going to be much more pro-Republicans rather than pro, I don't know, market, pro-rule of law, pro-constitution. I don't know how much of a constitutionalist he is. I don't think he is. I guess that's I'm slowly coming around to my position. My sense of Kavanaugh's, without getting into a lot of detail, is he's not a constitutionalist. He's not pro-constitution. Certainly not in the sense of which I understand the Constitution. Nobody's quite there. But not even in the sense that I think Gorsuch or Thomas understands the Constitution, who I think are the, relatively speaking, maybe the better, more constitutionally oriented judges on the court. All right, I guess I got one more Super Chat question from Nicholas. What are your thoughts about people on the left, such as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who advocate for abolition of ICE? I mean, I hate Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I mean, she is a socialist. She's horrible. She is the enemy, one of the enemies. But I also hate ICE. I consider ICE a little fascist organization. Breaking into businesses, rounding up people because they don't have documents, the right kind of documents. I just view them, I just find them despicable. I find that whole function, policing function, devoting a whole unit of the government, Homeland Security, to finding people who don't have the right documents. I find it fascist and horrible. By the way, Obama used ICE in horrible fashion. I find the whole idea that you can't work for an employer, that's not a voluntary transaction. And if I want to employ people, I don't get to choose who I employ. That ICE can come in and arrest them and can accuse me of employing them illegally, that I am violating the laws because of who I employ. I find that whole part of the law offensive. So while I would never agree with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on anything, and I don't agree with her reasoning for hating ICE, I hate ICE for my own reasons. I mean, I find the idea that on the I-5, Interstate 5, coming up from San Diego into Orange County, there is a massive installation where they slow cars down and inspect your car because you might have an illegal immigrant inside of it. I find that anti-American, horrible. Right? My wife looks Hispanic. So what, they're going to demand documents from her because of the way she looks? I mean, that's just disgusting. It's just so anti-individualism, so anti-individualistic. So I find what ICE does to be despicable. Regular police cannot look in my car unless they have a reason to look in my car. And they cannot stop me unless they have probable cause. And unless a crime has been committed, not a misdemeanor, a crime. They don't racially profile people for misdemeanors. So They can't just stop me randomly and ask me to open the trunk. They need a warrant. They can't just randomly stop me and ask for my driver's license. They need a reason. I might have been speeding. I might have a tail light that's broken or something, but they need a reason, right? They need a reason. The way that I look is not a reason unless they're racially profiled because of a serious crime has happened, right? So, you know, anyway, I find the whole idea in America that you have to have your documents with you, that you have to have an ID approved by the government with you, anti-American. I mean, it used to be that freedom-loving Americans even objected to a government-issued ID, right? We used to be against it. And we're not anymore, because now we want to document who's here legally and who's here illegally and who's a citizen and who's an immigrant and who's this and who's that when it starts categorizing people. Right? Well, you don't have to have an ID, but if you look a little different, if you look a little different today, then they can assume that you're here illegally. You now have to prove that you're legal. But how can you prove that you're legal if you don't have an ID? You have to go find your birth certificate. I mean, the whole process, the assumption is that you're guilty before proven, right? All right. Contact just said it. This is what they really think. Thank you, Contact, for actually saying what people think. If you are not born here, you got to go. Thanks for saying what I think a lot of people like you think. But that's not America. You guys want to start your own fascist country here in America? It's all yours. But, you know, it's not all yours. If you want to start your little fascist country here, you're going to have to fight me for it. But I, an immigrant who chose to come here, actually represent the founding fathers, and you don't. And I will fight you over this country in the name of the founding fathers, because this is not a country about birth. This is not a country about genes. This is not a country about blood. This is a country that stands for individualism. This is a country of ideas. And the idea that you have to be born here or you go out is an anti-American collectivistic little fascist idea. All right. That's enough, I think, for one day. We started with the crazy left wanting to ban plastics. And we ended with the crazy right wanting to ban anybody who's not born in America. That's America today. All right, you've been listening to the Aaron Brooks Show. You can support the show if you want to, if you choose, if you think you get value from it by going to Patreon and clicking on the Aaron Brooks Show, typing in the Aaron Brooks Show, and making a contribution. I very much appreciate it. We have crossed the 6,000, first phase, and now we're shooting straight for 10,000, trying to get there by the end of the year. Appreciate any support you can provide. Also, subscribe to my YouTube channel. A lot of very good material, very exciting material that I think you guys will enjoy. A lot of that material is going to go up in the next few weeks. A lot of my audio courses are going to go up on YouTube. You want to hear about when that happens, go subscribe to the channel. And other than that, stay rational. And I'll see you tomorrow. Don't forget tomorrow, we're going to be discussing Jordan Peterson. We're going to be discussing the conversation we had with Jordan Peterson at OCON. I'm going to have Greg Stelamiri and Ankar Gate, two of among my favorite living philosophers, on the show. And we're going to be discussing Jordan Peterson and our conversation with him. Don't miss that. It's at 5 p.m. Pacific time tomorrow. Bye, everybody. I will see you all tomorrow. Bye.